those are our upcoming events. But tonight, I'm very happy to be able to introduce Rob Schmidt, who is one of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea. Hi, come on in. Please have a seat. Rob is the spiritual director of the Taiyu Meditation Center, which is the owner of this store. And he has been teaching at the Taiyu Meditation Center now for, what, 15 years? 20 years?
25 years, I guess it would be.
Yeah. So, and tonight he will be talking about the synthesis of the heart. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you all for coming tonight. This is a hard talk to start, in a sense, because there are so many ways into the topic, so many ways out of the topic, so many ways around the topic. So we're just going to have to start where we find ourselves, right here, right now, in these bodies. And if you're like me, you've had the experience of realizing that your heart is at times divided, that it is pulling you in one direction at one moment and at the same moment apparently pulling you in another direction, or there are impulses arising in your body, whether you can label them the heart or the body, the intellect, the mind, however you want to characterize it. And there is this pulling apart happening inside ourselves, these conflicting impulses that arise. And that was certainly my experience when I first came to spiritual practice, when I first came to know my spiritual teacher. One of the things that was remarkable about him was his ability to have absolutely no ambiguity about his presence and intentions with regard to how he spoke from his heart. He had both the soft qualities that we sometimes are sometimes commonly associated with the heart, but he also could manifest the crystalline clarity that comes from this fusion that that can happen with practice. So this is an accomplishment that attracted me immensely. I couldn't put a name to it when I first saw it embodied in a human being. It's not something that we usually have our attention directed to, because people assume that the heart is the center of life and that we know what the heart tells us. There are songs that tell us, popular music that tells us what our heart is supposed to feel, the direction that our heart is supposed to take us. And yet, for me, I didn't find that those songs really pulled it together. It's not that I couldn't relate to or identify with the common experience of what people were telling me in song and in popular culture and in what I heard from people who I respected about psychology, etc. But it took someone who could embody that clarity unambiguously to be able to demonstrate that there is a way to pull the disparate threads of our interior lives together and weave them into a strong rope by which we can be secure and secure our connections to other people. We find ourselves, in general, drawn to people and repulsed by them at the same time. Drawn to some people more powerfully, repulsed by other people more powerfully, sometimes both in one person, very powerfully. Sometimes it alternates back and forth. But that thread of disparate, or those threads of disparate direction, pull our minds and our hearts with them. So that's kind of the problem I just wanted to sort of very briefly summarize here for you. I'm hoping this resonates at least somewhat for people. This makes sense to people's experience. It certainly looks to me as if people often have that kind of thing going on. So what is the what's the most profitable way to look at this situation? Well, the usual way is to just grit your teeth and pull it together, damn it, and I'm going to commit myself to that person or to that cause or to that property that I'm taking care of or to that business that I've established or to whatever professional career that I'm creating for myself, whatever the heck it happens to be. Right? I'm going to grit my teeth, I'm going to pull it together, I'm going to use will and intention and bring it into some focus, right? And the general experience of people is that that is less than 100% effective, especially as time goes on. Maybe at the very first there's a, you know, it feels great and things are together, but usually there's this declining curve of effectiveness, which can eventually result in feeling worse than we did to start with as we initiated the process. So that method doesn't seem to work. I certainly tried that. In my first relationship when I was in my early 20s, I had decided that this was it. The rest of my life, I was, you know, going to follow the romantic ideal and grit my teeth and make it work. But the universe had different ideas, and it didn't come together. So I found that not only was the person that I was directing this energy toward not able or willing to resonate with it, but neither was I able or willing to resonate with it internally, effectively, on a consistent basis. So when I met my teacher, I was ready to find something. I didn't even know, but I was ready to find something new, something different, something that could actually work. By the way, any comments, questions, observations at this point before I go on? Okay. Sounds like we're on the same page.
I think
okay, go ahead.
Is it universally the same, or is it at the outside different for every individual? Question?
My answer would be both. Which probably isn't the answer that you would wish necessarily. But we each come to our individuality trying to confront the this particular challenge of being located in this one body and yet being drawn to other people, other creations in this material plane. As I said, you know, could be a company, could be a house that you love, you know, a garden to which you are devoted. But often, it's people. And yet, even those things that we find ourselves most drawn to, we can find ourselves also repulsed by as well. It's a tough call. And partly it's the nature of this of the challenge that we're given in this realm with these bodies as we come to them. So it's true, this is a general problem, but then the particular way we have to deal with it is individual, with the individual karmic histories that we each have. So I don't know if that responds.
It does.
Adequately. Okay, good.
And who was this teacher that demonstrated that unambiguous?
His picture is actually on the back wall in the store. He was the inspiration for our creation of this store. His name was Robert Daniel Ennis, and he founded Tayu Meditation Center. He studied with several different teachers in various traditions. The best known one was a guy named E.J. Gold, who's written a number of different books, many of which we have here in the store as well. So, but he's not the only teacher who can manifest that kind of unity of purpose, unity of heart and mind, that is, in one sense, the goal of spiritual practice, at least as in one formulation that I would be happy to accept. There was a guy named Gurdjieff who was very influential to E.J. Gold and Robert Ennis and a number of other folks, who spoke in terms of pulling together these disparate impulses in a way that would allow us to do something that he called activating the higher emotional and intellectual center. I'm going to call the higher emotional center today the heart. We usually think of the heart as something which is unavoidable. But actually, I'm going to propose for your consideration tonight the possibility that we actually only fairly rarely access the genuine heart that is available, that is possible to contact, that is possible to synthesize, to bring together and grow. And so that's part of the direction I want to take this or explore this evening with you guys, is that the possibility that we have is to pull together these miseducated parts of ourselves in an effective way such that they can we can touch upon a heart energy that is present here all along, that was never not present, that never could be absent, but that we are misdirecting our attention with regard to. That is, we're looking at the wrong phenomena if we want to contact the heart, for the most part. I'm not saying it's 100%. Almost all of us have had some contact with the heart. But it's, or the higher emotional center. But it's not the common experience to be operating from that aspect of what we are here in this place. So what is our common experience? As I said before, it's this mishmash. It's being pulled back and forth in these different directions. And the way to pull these things together is to do what there's a book here in the store by a guy named Jacob Needleman. He talks about taking an intermediate step. An intermediate step is what we need. We all want to take the step, that big step, from our present sense of not feeling whole to this place where the heart is open, where we sense the connection between ourselves and with everything else as well, unambiguously and with clarity. But we need an intermediate step. In fact, maybe we need several intermediate steps, but let's just keep it singular for now. We need an intermediate step. And the step that I was introduced to by this fellow, Robert Ennis, was the step of actually witnessing objectively exactly where I am right now. Actually where all these disparate strands that I call me are right now. The part that wants to get up and dance, the part that wants to pull the covers over my head, the part that wants to sit down and read a book, the part that wants to make love, the part that wants to sing, all these different parts. We need to observe with absolute clarity. It sounds incredibly simple, and of course, when I state it in this way, it is incredibly simple. In one sense, that is the whole intermediate step, to learn to be present, absolutely unambiguously present with every part of who I am right now, right here, from the tippy tip of my toe to the top of my head, which includes this area that includes the heart center and maybe the lower emotional center. We can get to that in a minute. And all this stuff up here in what we are pleased to call the mind. We have to observe it all unambiguously, with complete clarity, with a powerful enough presence such that it doesn't overwhelm us, which is what normally happens. That's how you can define identification. This word that you often hear bandied about in spiritual circles. Identification is when those parts of ourselves are strong enough to pull our attention away from the rest. It's sort of like in a football game, somebody grabs the football and runs off the field and is running down the street. Something like that. You know? They're taken off. And then in the next moment, somehow some other impulse materializes, grabs the football, and runs off in a totally opposite direction. Actually, there's lots of footballs, and they're all going in different directions, and it's a three-dimensional nightmare in here, for the most part. But we need to be able to be present to all of that, which is happening simultaneously. Wow! That's some first step. So we have to break that first step up into smaller steps. And that's what spiritual practice is about. Maybe this is a good time for another question.
I've been trying to take small steps to understand who I am, and I feel like I've gone through an amazing transformation in the last year and a half, maybe, no, let's see, 2 to 3 years. It's been a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I have a good idea of who I am, about my wants and needs and what is necessary for me to function, you know, optimally. And but the thing I'm running into is when I speak directly from my heart and my intention is pure, I find it hard that society does not want to accept truth and depth of a person. I'm finding friends, you know, that I would confide in going, oh, that's too deep, you know, or, oh, can't you keep things on a light level? And it is a light level, but it's just like I'm speaking, I'm trying to be more organic and eco-friendly and, you know, put things out there that I truly care about, you know, and trying to educate people and just get other ideas and stuff about how people think and feel. But I'm finding that people are very resistant to letting themselves open up. So how can you relate when you're kind of deep and kind of in touch with who you are, and how do you communicate with other people without them completely shutting down because they're fearful of emotions? And how do you do that?
Thank you. That's a good question. I can't give you a bromide that would encapsulate it, or I could, but it would just be that, a bromide, a little trivial thing for your mind to latch on to and file, categorize away, and not be very useful. What I can tell you is the methodology that we use and that seems effective, and I'll tell you why I think some of that stuff seems effective. Number one is it's important to, when one is actually striving to learn to be honest with oneself, that one have the company of others so inclined and so engaged. That is to say, that you need, as the Buddha said, you need friends who are interested in the same project, the same basic project. We all need friends. We all need support in order to be able to be effective in creating a genuinely new life, not just a reshuffling of the deck chairs, but a genuinely new life. And so, the point I like to make is that we are mammals. We are social mammals. This is a herd right here. It's a very temporary coming together of these particular members of this particular group of social mammals. But the fact is, we constitute ourselves through our connections with other social mammals. Psychology and anthropology are very clear in their demonstration of this truth. If a baby requires social contact, a child requires social contact just to be physiologically normal, not even just psychologically normal, just to be physiologically normal, you have to have proximity to other mammals when you're a social member of a social mammal species. Well, that principle cannot be ignored when we attempt this extraordinary task of being absolutely rigorously honest with ourselves. We must have assistance. There's at least a couple of reasons for that, in addition to the one that I've just outlined. And one of those is that in addition to being social mammals, we are a social mammal with this big, pimple of a brain stuck on our heads. And this big thing is extraordinarily good at fabricating reasons to justify the existence of all these disparate, conflicting impulses. Everyone that comes up, there's a justification for it. In fact, there's several justifications for it. In fact, they're indispensable. My God, why did I think I could ever do without them? Right? That's how it works. That's how it works. So we need other people to remind us that, oh, no. Really, do you really need to, nurture that particular idea? Ultimately, all ideas about ourselves are just more identifications. And so it's very easy to get lost in a hall of mirrors of ideas about who we are and what we are, unless we have the assistance of like-minded individuals. And some of them we would wish to be skilled at seeing through our self-deceptions. That's an unusual set of conditions. In Taiyu Meditation Center, our organization that runs and owns this store, the idea is to have what we call a school. It's a school in the sense that it's not something that we expect to have to attend, if you will, permanently. That is, it is a tool that we use for a certain type of development, and then we get on to live our lives, have our careers, have our spiritual careers. That spiritual career of being honest, absolutely honest, moment by moment. Another reason is just the reason that you pointed out. We need to get skillful at being able to be honest. Let's say that we've got the help of someone who has some skill at saying, I'm not so sure about that particular idea, or that doesn't seem quite right, or whatever it happens to be, whatever feedback we need to keep us literally honest. Assuming that we've got that, we need to be able to understand how to manifest that in the world outside our group of supportive co-practitioners. And that takes practice. Like anything, it's like, learning to swim. You have to, on land, at least when I was a little kid, you go through the motions of the strokes, and then you get in the water and you practice them and stuff like that. Same thing. But the way you do it safely is doing it with these people that you are engaged in this project with. That's how you get the kind of practice that you need to be able safely to be in the world and not just safely do it, because it's not just a matter of safety for this being, but it's a matter of being of service to all other beings skillfully. Women and men who can be honest with other people are relatively rare. And the skillful honesty that it takes to be able to speak truth to power, whether it's the power of a government or the power of an egoic manifestation in somebody's head, just one other person's head, doesn't particularly matter. The scale doesn't particularly matter, except as a matter of getting practice in dealing with the energetics of those different contexts, if you follow what I'm saying. So that's some of the challenges about learning to do this kind of project effectively. It is multifaceted. If we're going to be successful, if we're going actually to be able to make some real changes in the body of habits that we currently have, and I'm not referring here just to emotional habits, but it's the body of habits of our minds and the body of habits of our physical bodies as well. If we're going to be able to make changes to those, then we need every assistance that we can get. So, does that help respond to your question? Good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I want more too.
I do have another question now.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're around people, not necessarily friends, but relatives,
mm-hmm.
who have seen you in a certain light for so long, and you've made this change and it's
mm-hmm.
manifested to this better being, and you're still on your plate, sometimes they expect you to be the same person mm-hmm. you were 3 years ago, whatever, 10 years ago, and they're like,
sometimes
I know you as this person, and you're like, but I'm really this person, you know, I've made this great change, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That's one of the most difficult things of all, and also one of the best tests of real maturity and growth, is to be able to go to your parents or to your siblings or, you know, aunts and uncles, whatever we're talking about here, the whole mishpacha, to go to all of those people and to be able to manifest clarity with those people who know every weakness, have great skill in trotting upon every corn, on every toe of every foot. When you can maintain clarity in that context, then you'll know that you've achieved something. The goal, to me, is not to change them. Or to insist on them seeing you differently. It's to create a you that is so much bigger than the old you that they literally don't see the old you. That all they can see is the new you. Or at least, I mean, no doubt there would be, you know, there'd be this tension between those two. What's that? Yeah.
It's very strange, you know. I think the best, you know, obviously the best teacher is by demonstrating, you know,
yeah.
your strength and what you've done, but I can't help but going home and going, geez, why do they do this to me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it's a test. But it's like, it's not like during the thing where I'm like engaging in their, you know, their attacks, you know, I just...
Mm-hmm.
try and look at it from different angles and see where they're coming from, but like at home is when it gets to me, when I'm like, why do they have to do this? You know, so it's like, I have this open heart when I'm around people, friends and family and coworkers sometimes, but when I go home I feel like this funk, like I got like
mm-hmm.
slime or something on my aura or whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
just kind of like dulling me out.
Well, That's what you actually bring up an important point, which I want to speak to at least briefly before I get to the other question here, which is that it's not just about cultivating an open heart that I'm talking about here. It's actually, in another sense, it's cultivating a transparent heart. A heart that grows so big, I'm sort of combining some metaphors here, that it grows transparent to the slings and arrows of the barbs and insults that we are assailed with from friends, family, whoever, acquaintances, whoever it happens to be. In other words, when that heart grows so large through skillful practice, it is not just willing yourself to be open. That doesn't work, at least in my experience. I haven't seen it work reliably and consistently in other people's lives. But when we can learn to do that, then our families, to the extent that they can grow enough to see a bigger person than we are, will often lay off. That's been my experience, to a certain extent, and with exceptions, because individuals are individuals, and we can't control who they are. But like especially with it's especially tough for parents, for example, to see their children differently than who we conceive them to be. But to be able to demonstrate a maturity to one's parent is actually a great gift to that parent. So thank you for the questions. I want to get to this gentleman who had a question over here.
You used the word simultaneous when you were talking about the presence.
Yes.
What's happening inside?
Yes.
That made me curious of your relationship with that and the significance of that for you.
Got that. The simultaneity that I was speaking of is the product of the spiritual practices that I have engaged in now for over 30 years, which have allowed me to play with consciousness, sort of like you play with a what are those little balls?
Hand
squeeze thing. In other words, sometimes you can squeeze it really tiny. In other words, you can narrow the focus of consciousness very finely and have enormous attention on one aspect of life. But you can also go the other way, and that's what people generally think of when they think of cultivating consciousness or increasing consciousness often. But the other thing is to expand consciousness, but not in such a way that it is so attenuated that it's virtually useless. The goal is to be able to expand such that one is more aware than one was when one started the whole process of a lot of different things in one's field of consciousness, more than one could have been of one single thing in one's field of consciousness to start with, because our attention is so pulled like taffy. It's like it's just all over the place. Much of the time, not all the time, but much of the time, because of all these conflicting impulses in what Gurdjieff would have called the three centers of the being. Or you could divide it up by chakras, or whatever you want to do.
But you could use the Jewish Kabbalah.
Absolutely, and probably our speaker Reb Tzvi Bar David will do that in a couple of weeks. So it doesn't matter the way you look at it from that perspective, but the point is to be able to learn how to grow your consciousness so that it's utterly plastic. It's not just that it's all the time expanded in this nebulous cloud around you, nor is it all the time focused narrowly on a point. But we need to be able, in order to respond effectively to the challenges that we were talking about earlier, and other challenges, to be able to, sort of like breathing in some ways, things have to move, things have to be elastic. And so that's what I mean by this simultaneity. It's like I can be aware of this lady over here and of you at the same time. Sometimes I can be aware of her even when I'm not seeing her physically, because I can be paying attention to other aspects of the material sensorium as well as other aspects of how consciousness impinges upon this space here. So, you know, that's after 30 years, and I'm still working on it. But you know, there's ultimately no, at least in the space of a human lifetime, there's certainly no limit to how good we can get with this sort of play. And it's also, you know, I also want to point out, it's not just, you know, the contrast in size, it's also the contrast in speed. Being able quickly to go to different places, to inhabit different emotional and intellectual and physical places. So sometimes it's as simple as being able to be present in my toes, because I need to be present in my toes. I need to have my consciousness really aware of my toes sometimes. And just be able to do that. It's like flipping a switch. Other times, there are other demands pulling me towards a cup of tea. A cup of delicious tea, in fact. And just so with the emotional life as well. I need to be able, if I want to be free, to be liberated, to be not constrained by the habits with which I created the being that was named Robert Arthur Schmidt when he was born, but to be able to manifest something totally different than that being had in his repertoire throughout the first 25 years of his life. And that takes this intermediate step that I've been speaking about the last few minutes. Does that respond? Or do you want more?
It's interesting.
Okay. It is interesting, I agree.
It's a response.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Maybe I gave you more than you wanted. This stuff is interesting. Playing with consciousness is interesting. Playing with the heart is interesting. Sometimes we get this idea that the heart is this, I don't know, this pretty pink crystalline little thing, and if you chip it, you might as well throw it out and get a new one or something like that. Or I'm trying to create a metaphor here to describe the attitude that we sometimes see of the heart as being stuck, as being not able to grow. And if there's anything that I'd like to suggest to you tonight, it's that view is an obstacle to learning how to change and be free in your emotional lives. The heart is not is not conceived in a plaster cast, unable to grow beyond certain bounds. The heart, at its best, is boundless, or always growing, or growing as much as we can accomplish it. So that's a cool challenge to undertake. The challenge of growing this heart so that it can encompass other people in this space, for example. So that I can, or you can, resonate with your heart what's going on in the heart of someone else. Or maybe the heart of a group. So that's a challenge. To be good at it, that's a challenge. But, you know, it's an interesting challenge. So, yeah.
When you first met
my teacher.
Your teacher.
Yeah.
What struck you as most profound, I guess I would say, and that you found the reason why you wanted to continue to learn from your teacher?
Yeah. That's a really a wonderful question, actually. In some ways, it's the heart, and we keep returning to that word, the heart of the whole endeavor. Because what is it that draws us to genuine practice? And when genuine practice is founded on a heart-to-heart connection, such as I was describing, both in the context of the life of social primates, but also as this thing that we can grow, that question is central. So my answer is that I can remember very clearly having this feeling this flush of warmth through my body, my trunk and head, and not knowing why it was there, except I knew it was somehow focused on him. It's nothing that he was doing explicitly, because I inadvertently showed up at this little meeting that he was conducting, reading Sufi stories. And people were passing this book around and reading Sufi stories, and Robert was commenting on them, and responding to people's questions and that sort of thing. So on the surface, there was nothing in particular going on. But there was this magnetic, energetic something that for me was incredibly powerful. And so I knew I had to figure out what that was about. I knew I had to discover what was going on with that, because it wasn't. It was a kind of attraction that I hadn't experienced before. Sure, I knew sexual attraction, but this was, beyond merely sexual attraction. So I had to figure out what that was about, and so that's why I was drawn. That's the most basic answer, because the second level was, I guess, the level of the higher intellectual center, because everything he said was stuff that I'd never heard. Well, not everything he said, but much of what he said was stuff I'd never heard before, and that made absolute sense to me. Or it was that level of apprehension of it's as if you knew it in your head already, but you've never heard it articulated in your head or elsewhere before. That's what it was like. So that was the other half of the puzzle that I had to deal with. So when we come to practice, it's about something beyond just our own egoic needs. I was 24 years old. I was a kid. I was a kid who, had some illusions shattered about relationship at that point. Didn't have much expectation for a particularly happy life. Not unhappy by many standards, but I was pretty, moderately to fairly miserable in terms of not having a clue as to how to make myself happy. Or, to put it in the language I used a moment ago, to free myself, to liberate myself from the the bodies of habit of the of these aspects of the organism that, that I was that I couldn't even describe, and except in small part. So what Robert told me to do was to be present with those bodies of habit, to observe them, to witness them as objectively as possible. There's a few very simple techniques to do that. Very, very basic, very simple. Such as something called self-observation meditation. And it's a form of meditation where we establish a witness consciousness aspect of consciousness. And everything we do gets observed from that. We can do that right now, very quickly here, if you wish. So if you imagine a line drawn up your spine out the crown of your head, a line perpendicular to that through the third eye or, you know, through the forehead, where those two lines intersect in your in the sort of the back of your head, middle or back of your head, just imagine a microscopic video camera. Video camera that records everything. And you should have your eyes open. I encourage you to at least to have your eyes open as you do this. You can let your eyes rest in one spot just for this particular aspect of the exercise, because it's easier to do to start. But you simply observe everything that's arising, every sensation in the body, every manifestation of the emotional center, usually experienced in this part of the body here, solar plexus and chest. And also all the voices in our heads, the images that arise in our heads, etc. Observe all of those impartially through this video camera. The video camera does not comment. It does not observe. It does not. It does not evaluate, criticize. It does not speak. It does not speak. Now, that's the most crucial aspect of it. It simply absorbs this information, absorbs these impressions. So you can do this as I'm speaking right now. It's like this little, just this little tiny thing. That's all. We try to do this in the midst of daily life as much as we can remember to do it. It's the basic thing we try to do. When we come together in the groups, you know, that I spoke of earlier, to exchange these sort of comradely energies that are so important to us as social mammals, we talk about the stuff that has arisen as a result of doing this practice, and several others. But this is the basic one.
So you just observe it.
Just observe it. You do nothing more. If something tries to do something with or to any of the phenomena that you're observing, then that is something that must be observed as well. It's remarkable because it's sort of like starting an avalanche with a flake of snow. Now, this little observation viewpoint is like a flake of snow. But if you roll it down the hill of your life for long enough, then there is information and energy going into this aspect of consciousness that does not participate in the habits that I talked about earlier. The habits of reactivity, of compulsive reactivity, that get us into trouble, that lead us to doing things. Even when we're in the midst of doing them, we know how stupid they are, how ineffective they are, how troublemaking they are, and yet we can't stop ourselves because those habits are so strong. Well, this is a way to start the process of taking the energy that we have available and redirecting it elsewhere. So that's in answer to your question. We also have another very powerful yet gentle meditation technique that we call co-meditation. It's a two-person meditation form. So I can practice it with you right now by establishing and maintaining eye contact with you and not thinking about, not projecting egoic agendas, etc., onto you as much as possible, but simply putting my attention upon you. And you, likewise, can do the same. So, see? Just thinking about it, wow! That'll change things.
Right.
That is extremely well put. We don't usually do that very much. Usually, when we're with other people, we are mostly below the surface level of consciousness, we are projecting our fears and expectations and manipulations of other people to make ourselves feel safe or to get them to do what we want, the other person to do what we want. So that's the other basic technique. That's just the simplest, the very simplest form. We actually have a whole, series of elaborations of that, that co-meditation technique as well, to pull people in. But and it's been getting more powerful lately as we've been incorporating more of the heart-centered stuff in there for our core practitioners. But that stuff is it's simple, but when practiced consistently, can produce amazing results. And that's how it works. It's really hard to change things in an instant. Sometimes things will appear to change in an instant, and yet it's only the preceding 3 years of effort that has made that sea change possible. And so, in spiritual practice, it's not the hare, but it's the tortoise, that's the consistent, plodding tortoise of self-observation practice, of co-meditation practice, or equivalent practices in other traditions that can produce that intermediate step, which allows us to flip to the place where suddenly, holy crap, this is open. This is open. This is not guarded anymore. The wall has crumbled. The doors have been flung open. Air is flowing in.
So when you say you are in your head and you're observing, you're just like staying aware of your thoughts and your feelings.
And bodily sensations. In many ways, the bodily sensations are the most important.
So you're just like being aware of it, but not trying to change it. Just,
correct. Just absolutely correct. Not
awareness.
Not changing it whatsoever. So it ultimately becomes. I was talking earlier about being able to be elastic with consciousness. As you get better at doing this kind of meditation, there's we can increase the speed with which we can observe. That is, it's sort of like our surface consciousness doesn't have much RAM, doesn't have much memory. And we can increase the amount of effective processing speed by engaging in these processes such that we can come to be aware of processes, habits running through our hearts and heads and bodies that go very quickly most of the time. Because the routinized channels of those habit energies are grooved so deeply that it just goes lickety split. We need to be able to increase the speed of and processing speed of surface consciousness, if you will.
Especially if you're mentally obsessing.
That's exactly the sort of thing that will give you the energy, if you observe it, to do exactly what we're talking about.
Because
mentally obsessing.
I'm in a loop sometime, and I'll think to myself, I just thought that 3 times. Now I'm obsessing. Now I'm thinking again.
Right. The Hall of Mirrors. There it is.
Right. But you don't try to change it. You just observe it.
The act of observation pulls, not a lot of energy, especially not at first, but pulls energy away from that process. It bleeds energy from that process. All these processes, all these habits take energy.
So you're going to change it without trying to change it.
That's the intermediate step.
Yeah.
Exactly right. That's the intermediate step. You are not exercising a direct attack on the egoic habits. You are doing it indirectly in a way such that the ego is not threatened, or most of the time is not threatened. You know, if you're just observing what's going on, actually sometimes just the act of observation will change something, you know. But in other cases, the more deeply channeled habit energies, you know, it takes a lot of observation to really be able to see those fully and completely. So it's variable depending on what phenomenon you're looking at. But remember that this self-observation witness consciousness is making no such discrimination. It is simply absorbing. It is simply pulling in information, pulling in data, pulling in impressions. Eating impression food is one metaphor that gets used. It's just going in. It's never commenting, describing, analyzing, evaluating.
So you don't even think I'm obsessing, or there's that thought again.
Right? Or you're just observing the thought I'm obsessing. And observing the thought that I'm obsessing about obsessing, and observing the thought about I'm obsessing about obsessing about obsessing. Yeah. Thank you. Is that clear?
I think so.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't work, I
it's a process.
I'm thinking, and she says, "You're still thinking about that."
Hey, we can see what other people are thinking way more than we usually are willing to admit or give credit to. You know, that is, you know, people's, when we do this co-meditation thing that I was talking about earlier, you can see the thoughts in the other person. You can see them. It doesn't mean you can read them as if you can hear their voice, although sometimes that can occur. But you can see whether the mind is still or the mind is agitated. And often in what there's a flavor to that agitation. And the better you get at it, the more you can see, and the more your own mind is clear so you can attune yourself, the better you can pick up what's going on for the other person. Assuming that's important to do, and sometimes it is. But that's part of this thing that I've stressed a few times about being of service. Part of the intermediate step is to realize that spiritual practice is about being of service. It's about being of service to other people. So opening your heart is not just and cannot be just for you. It has to be about giving your heart. Otherwise, it's not opening the heart, really. Otherwise, it's some subtle egoic manipulation. Maybe not so subtle egoic manipulation, depending. This is very tricky stuff. That's why we need, as I said before, you know, in response to this lady's question, we need to have feedback. Because you need to have people to tell you, uh-oh, I think you're fooling yourself here on this one. Right? That's important. Because we can fool ourselves oh so effectively. No one better than me to fool me, to mislead me, to misdirect me. Yeah, that's the way it works for us. Thank you. Yeah?
In the movie Castaways,
mm-hmm.
where Tom Hanks, or whatever his character was, and he's so alone, and he finds Mr. Wilson. Mr. Wilson becomes his witness, and he takes both parts. He talks to Mr. Wilson and himself.
Oh, cool.
In order
I haven't seen the movie.
Wilson is a basketball.
Yeah.
Mr. Wilson. Oh, cool. I got that. Right.
Basketball. And all of a sudden he finds that he can do all these things that he didn't think he could ever do.
What a wonderful metaphor.
It's a marvelous teaching story. It really is.
Wonderful.
Because he's on a desert island.
Right.
And he goes through all of the things, wanting to kill himself, and he can't. But then he learns how to catch fish, learns how to make fire, and that was the highlight when he could, I made fire. And all of us, basically, in the exercise you're saying, we learn to make our own fire in our own light.
Thank you.
And we don't have to put it on somebody else. We don't have to project it on somebody else. We have to find that other part of us that is silent.
Beautifully said. Thank you.
So what do you think his service in that movie, I'm sorry you don't know, but in that movie that he was seen it, except for the fact that he does get off the island and gets rescued and goes and joins the human race again, right?
Mm-hmm.
Am I remembering it right? If he didn't ever make it back to humanity...
But he did.
Did yeah, okay.
Because you remember who he was in the beginning?
Yeah, right.
Okay. He
was power hungry, money hungry.
Yeah. And fat and just obsessive.
And always and putting off the things he really loved to do because I've got more important things to do. He was totally identified with it.
I mean, he just was not.
Sounds like a pretty good metaphor for some of the stuff that we're talking about.
The service basically comes when you serve yourself. You don't expect other people to do it for you.
Exactly right. Because we do. That's why we're manipulating people.
That's right.
Both overtly and subconsciously. Right. All the time, is we're trying to get other people to make us okay.
Uh-huh.
We seek other relationships. Yeah.
The three back here, but it's you doing it.
Yeah.
These three fingers point back to me.
That's right. So, it's this charity begins at home is another way to say this. If we're going to really be of service, we first have to begin with ourselves, because we're not capable of being of service until we can witness the other. That's why this co-meditation practice is one that's so central for us, because we are learning, because we're doing both sides. We're being the witness to another, and we are being witnessed ourselves. And that externalization of that process, which also takes place internally with the self-observation that I was talking about, is a really good balance we find, you know, having the internalization of it and the externalization of this process. Excuse me, very important, very useful. Thank you. Lisa's a smart lady. But she's demonstrated that many times here in this space.
I'm also a dumb lady. They go hand in hand.
That's when you're not speaking. Thank you. Other questions, comments, observations? So this process of opening the heart, of making the heart palpable, both more present and elastic, is a different configuration than we generally think of in terms of how we're supposed to treat, how we're supposed to synthesize a heart. Gurdjieff talked about this an idea such that we don't really have a fully developed soul. We're born with the blueprint of a soul, and we have to create a soul through the sort of intermediate steps that we've just been talking about tonight. Well, the same thing, the same principle, works here. That's why the title of the talk, Synthesis of the Heart. We bring together disparate elements to create this function, this organism, this organ, that does the work of connecting ourselves beyond where we started out. We started out as an individual in this body. And one of the things that we're here to do, it seems to me at least, is to learn how to connect this body, this material reality, to the rest of the material reality and the manifestations from beyond that in these other aspects of the creation, you guys, and the other you guys out there. It's a big challenge. And it's not something, you know, I have to stress this, it's not something we can do for the most part effectively without help, for the reasons that we talked about earlier. We need help from people who are doing a similar project. You know, the Buddha, you know, Jim, my good friend Jim here, has led for many years a group reading the Buddhist sutras. And one of the things that the Buddha is recorded as having said over and over again is the importance of having friends in practice. The crucial importance of having friends in practice. So it's not, you know, this is not a new insight. You don't need the psychology, sociology, and anthropology to recognize the importance of that part of the project. But we can do wonderful things together. We can create wonderful, what we like to call them, co-creations. This meeting together here is a co-creation. We have created a space where some interesting energies have arisen. Some interesting questions have been examined. And that's a cool thing. That's a nice accomplishment. But don't pat yourselves on the back, because you'll just dislocate your shoulder.
Sometimes.
Well, just the opposite. I'm wondering if coming to a place like this sometimes, it's been an experience to go home and say, I wish I had said it, or why didn't I speak up? The victim that some of us have been known to
That's a common habit energy.
Right,
yes.
And so I'm wondering if you have anything to say about how to fight that aspect of being in what do you call it, practice together, and finding that that's enlightening and a wonderful experience at the time, but then is it not true? It doesn't follow you unless maybe there's something you can teach us. How do you keep it at that level? Or do you let it go up and down? You just watch it. Okay, I got it. I learned.
Well, the video that's... That part is true too. Okay. But the way to change your relationship to that is no more difficult than what I've just said, which is to find a band of fellow travelers who are serious about, you know, as serious a group as you can find, mm-hmm. in terms of really wanting to do this stuff,
okay.
and hanging out with them as much as possible. The question about family and friends is important because they are wonderful reminders in many ways, and challenges ultimately, mm-hmm. and tests by which we can see at various points along the way how far we've gotten. But to get to the point where we can actually hope to negotiate a successful test with those individuals, we need help. Mm-hmm. We need help. I mean, that's in many ways that's one of the hardest things for us, you know, individual cowgirl, cowboy Americans to go with, is I need help. I need assistance with this. And so that's my basic response, is that if you really want consistent results, then consistent cultivation with a group is there's no substitute for it, or almost no substitute for it. There have been a very, very few instances of people throughout history that we know of who, on their own, without the sort of assistance that I'm talking about, were able to achieve the kind of liberation I'm talking about. But, you know, as my teacher used to say, if you were one of those people, you would already be at that point. I certainly was never there. God forbid to make such a claim. Far, far from it.
One of the other things that I have observed for me is sometimes what I think is my enemy is my best friend because they've told me the truth.
Absolutely, because it's and even these people who we think are telling us things we don't want to know, mm-hmm. Are actually telling us that actually, yeah, you still got some mm-hmm. of that, mm-hmm. you know, sister or child or whatever it happens to be, relationship, mm-hmm. Role, energy in you. That habit energy has not been expunged. Yeah, has not been fully liberated. So, and that's useful. But I do recommend spending time with other people who can help you go further beyond it, in addition to going back to those people. In other words, there needs to be a balance. You need to have that elasticity in life that I was talking about with regard to consciousness itself a little while ago. And that's, you know, that's important. It's crucial even. Thank you. Other comments, questions? Well, I think that's probably pretty much what I wanted to do tonight, and what feels like a nice co-creation. I want to briefly mention that the activities of Tai Yu Meditation Center are listed in some cases on our store newsletter here. We have a Tai Yu Death Intensive Workshop coming up a week from Saturday on May 31st at Tai Yu House outside town here, about 3 miles from here. And that will be, that's in honor of the 10th anniversary the next day of the passing of our founder, Robert Ennis, the guy I was talking about earlier. So that's a big activity we're looking forward to. We also have ongoing group meetings. We have a group meeting that happens here every Monday except the fourth Monday of the month, which, as it happens, is this next, the fourth Monday is this next one. But then subsequent, first, second, third, and fifth, when it happens, Mondays, we meet here in this store for an ongoing group called Soul Without Measure. We have
in the evening.
I beg your pardon?
In the evening.
7:30 p.m. Yeah. Same time here. And we also have other activities, a Sunday meditation communion on once or twice a month at Taiyu House in 10 a.m. in the morning on a Sunday. The next one, I think, is June 15th because of our memorial celebration coming up on June 1st, which would ordinarily be the next one. And ongoing other activities as well. So thank you all for coming tonight. It's been very enjoyable.
Thank you.